Reform or Revolution by Rosa Luxemburg. Chapter 1. The Opportunist Method. If it is true that theories are only the images of the phenomena of the exterior world in the human consciousness, it must be added, concerning Edward Bernstein's system, that theories are sometimes inverted images. Think of a theory of instituting socialism by means of social reforms in the face of the complete stagnation of the reform movement in Germany. Think of a theory of trade union control. Consider the theory of winning a majority in Parliament after the revision of the Constitution of Saxony and in view of the most recent attempts against universal suffrage. However, the pivotal point of Bernstein's system is not located in his conception of the practical tasks of social democracy. It is found in his stand on the course of the objective development of capitalist society, which, in turn, is closely bound to his conception of the practical tasks of the social democracy. According to Bernstein, a general decline of capitalism seems to be increasingly improbable because, on the one hand, capitalism shows a greater capacity of adaptation, and on the other hand, capitalist production becomes more and more varied. The capacity of capitalism to adapt itself, says Bernstein, is manifested first in the disappearance of general crises resulting from the development of the credit system, employers' organizations, wider means of communication and informational services. It shows itself, secondly, in the tenacity of the middle classes, which hails from the growing differentiation of the branches of production and the elevation of vast layers of the proletariat to the level of the middle class. It is furthermore proved, argues Bernstein, by the amelioration of the economic and political situation of the proletariat as a result of its trade union activity. From this theoretic stand is derived the following general conclusion about the practical work of the social democracy. The latter must not direct its daily activity toward the conquest of political power, but toward the betterment of the condition of the working class within the existing order. It must not expect to institute socialism as a result of political and social crises, but should build socialism by means of the progressive extension of social control and the gradual application of the principle of cooperation. Bernstein himself sees nothing new in his theories. On the contrary, he believes them to be in agreement with certain declarations of Marx and Engels. Nevertheless, it seems to us that it is difficult to deny that they are in formal contradiction with the conceptions of scientific socialism. If Bernstein's revisionism merely consisted in affirming that the march of capitalist development is slower than it was thought before, he would merely be presenting an argument for adjourning the conquest of power by the proletariat, on which everybody agreed up to now. Its only consequence would be a slowing up of the pace of the struggle. But that is not the case. What Bernstein questions is not the rapidity of the development of capitalist society, but the march of the development itself, and, consequently, the very possibility of a change to socialism. Socialist theory up to now declared that the point of departure for a transformation to socialism would be a general and catastrophic crisis. We must distinguish in this outlook two things: the fundamental idea and its exterior form. The fundamental idea consists of the affirmation that capitalism, as a result of its own inner contradictions, moves toward a point when it will become unbalanced, when it will simply become impossible. there were good reasons for conceiving that juncture in the form of a catastrophic general commercial crisis. But that is of secondary importance when the fundamental idea is considered. The scientific basis of socialism rests, as is well known, on three principal results of capitalist development. First, on the growing anarchy of capitalist economy, leading inevitably to its ruin. Second, on the progressive socialization of the process of production, which creates the germs of the future social order. And third, on the increased organization and consciousness of the proletarian class, which constitutes the active factor in the coming revolution. Bernstein pulls away from the first of the three fundamental supports of scientific socialism. He says that capitalist development does not lead to a general economic collapse. He does not merely reject a certain form of the collapse. He rejects the very possibility of collapse. He says, textually, quote, "One could claim that by collapse of the present society is meant something else than a general commercial crisis, worse than all others. That is a complete collapse of the capitalist system brought about as a result of its own contradictions." And to this he replies, quote, "With the growing development of society, a complete and almost general collapse of the present system of production becomes more and more improbable, because capitalist development increases on the one hand the capacity of adaptation, and on the other, that is at the same time, the differentiation of industry." From Neue Zeit, 1897-98. But then the question arises, why and how, in that case, can we attain the final goal? According to scientific socialism, the historic necessity of the socialist revolution manifests itself above all in the growing anarchy of capitalism, which drives the system into an impasse. But if one admits with Bernstein that capitalist development does not move in the direction of its own ruin, then socialism ceases to be objectively necessary. There remain the other two mainstays of the scientific explanation of socialism, which are also said to be consequences of capitalism itself: the socialization of the process of production and the growing consciousness of the proletariat. It is these two matters that Bernstein has in his mind when he says, quote, "The suppression of the theory of collapse does not in any way deprive socialist doctrine of the power of persuasion. For, examined closely, what are all factors enumerated by us that make the case for the suppression or the modification of the former crises? Nothing else, in fact, than the conditions, or even in party the germs, of the socialization of production and exchange." End quote. Very little reflection is needed to understand that here, too, we face a false conclusion. Where lies the importance of all the phenomena that are said by Bernstein to be the means of capitalist adaptation? Cartels, the credit system, the development of means of communication, the amelioration of the situation of the working class, etc.? Obviously, in that they suppress, or at least attenuate, the internal contradictions of the capitalist economy, and stop the development or the aggravation of these contradictions. Thus, the suppression of crises can only mean the suppression of the antagonism between production and exchange on the capitalist base. The amelioration of the situation of the working class, or the penetration of certain fractions of the class into middle layers, can only mean the attenuation of the antagonism between capital and labor. But if the mentioned factors suppress the capitalist contradictions, and consequently save the system from ruin, if they enable capitalism to maintain itself, and that is why Bernstein calls them, quote, means of adaptation, how can cartels, the credit system, trade unions, etc., be at the same time the conditions and even in part the germs of socialism? Obviously, only in the sense that they express most clearly the social character of production. But by presenting it in its capitalist form, the same factors render superfluous, inversely, in the same measure, the transformation of this socialized production into socialist production. That is why they can be the germs or conditions of a socialist order, only in the theoretic sense and not in an historic sense. They are phenomena which, in the light of our conception of socialism, we know to be related to socialism, but which, in fact, not only do not lead to a socialist revolution, but render it, on the contrary, superfluous. There remains one force making for socialism, the class consciousness of the proletariat. But it, too, is in the given case now the simple intellectual reflection of the growing contradictions of capitalism and its approaching decline. It is now no more than an ideal whose force of persuasion rests only on the perfection attributed to it. We have here, in brief, the explanation of the socialist program by means of, quote, pure reason. We have here, to use simpler language, an idealist explanation of socialism. The objective necessity of socialism, the explanation of socialism as the result of the material development of society, falls to the ground. Revisionist theory thus places itself in a dilemma. Either the socialist transformation is, as was admitted up to now, the consequence of the internal contradictions of capitalism, and with the growth of capitalism will develop its inner contradictions, resulting inevitably at some point in its collapse. In that case, the means of adaptation are ineffective, and the theory of collapse is correct. Or the means of adaptation will really stop the collapse of the capitalist system, and thereby enable capitalism to maintain itself by suppressing its own contradictions. In that case, socialism ceases to become a historic necessity. It then becomes anything you want to call it, but it is no longer the result of the material development of society. The dilemma leads to another. Either revisionism is correct in its position on the course of capitalist development, and therefore the socialist transformation of society is only a utopia, or socialism is not a utopia, and the theory of means of adaptation is false. There is the question in a nutshell.